Hey, it's Esme Murphy with here with my guest this hour, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. How are you, sir?
Well, how about you?
I am doing great. Hey, just wanted to let you know that it's great to have you back here in the U.S. How was your trip to Eastern Europe?
It was good. I was in two different countries. I was in Lithuania, which was my fifth trip, and my first trip to Minsk in Belarus.
Wow. Okay, so how long were you over there?
I was there for exactly 2 weeks, so it was the, so I flew out on 2 weeks ago on Saturday, and I got back yesterday evening.
Wow, okay. And just let me ask you, one of the things I was really interested to hear was, did you get a lot of questions over there about what's going on in the U.S.?
Oh, I did. I think there's two or three different areas that were of most interest. You know, one of them, of course, is all things Donald Trump. There's no question about that. And we can come back and talk about it in a second here. The second topic was all about the guns, the Second Amendment, and demonstrations, because, maybe a lot of people don't realize that outside of the United States, it's actually very, very difficult for most people across the world to own a gun. And in both of these countries, it's literally impossible to own a gun at all. And so they were really interested in the questions all about, you know, the Second Amendment, what's it mean? I was going to say that they got beyond the Hollywood images. You know, what I mean by the Hollywood images of thinking that everybody, you know, totes a gun at their belt. But they were more interested in what impact I thought that the demonstrations were going to have, and in terms of, you know, what we might think in terms of the future of gun regulation in the United States. So that was one big topic. The second topic was specifically Trump and Putin. And keep in mind, we're part of the world I was in. Both Lithuania and Belarus were part of the Soviet Union during the communist era. Both of them border on the Russian Federation. And they were concerned that even when Obama was president, that we didn't take Russia seriously enough. And they're very, very concerned, especially after when Russia invaded Ukraine, or part of Ukraine a couple years ago, very concerned that we're not taking Russia seriously enough as a threat to them or as a threat to world peace.
So they see Russia as a threat.
There's no question about it, because Russia has troops right at the border. And even this week when I was there, Russia was doing military exercises in the Baltics, the Baltic Sea, again, right where they are. So they see Russia as a major threat. And again, remember, again, at least with the case of Lithuania, that Lithuania was independent in 1939, and eventually gets taken over by Russia. Russia holds on to them along with Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia until the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. So they view Russia as clearly a major, major threat, and are worried that again, Donald Trump, you know, that even though some of his staff has ramped up the sanctions against Putin and Russia, they're very concerned that Trump himself, is not taking Putin seriously enough in terms of a threat to world peace, or would not be there, the United States, if in fact Putin were to take action against Lithuania. Now, Belarus is a little bit different, because Belarus is still part of a trading bloc with Russia. I mean, what's really fascinating that both Lithuania and Belarus are neighbors, but Lithuania is part of the European Union. It's part of NATO. It's really become a stable democratic society, actually a quite nice one. Whereas Belarus is still a relatively authoritarian society, not heavily visited by Americans. And the U.S. is very, very interested in trying to sort of push it over into the democratic side. Its current president was also the president or the head of Belarus back when it was still part of the Soviet Union. So he's pretty old, and they're preparing for, that is, the State Department is preparing for a day you know, it could be 5 years, could be 10 years when he dies, and what happens in terms of the next step. So I was over there teaching at an international university, and also, as some listeners know, that when I travel abroad, I usually do some work, some speaking engagements for the State Department. So I gave a talk at the U.S. Embassy on Thursday, talking all about the 2018 elections, about Trump and so forth. It was a wonderful time.
Right. And in terms of are they interested in actually President Trump sort of in terms of his persona, in terms of the way he, you know, goes about being president? But certainly he is a president unlike any other, you know, using Twitter, speaking off the cuff, throwing out the script. Were they interested in Trump personally?
Yes, they were. What was really interesting is how well informed many of them were all about the United States and about Donald Trump. You know, because Donald Trump is, besides being president, you know, of the United States, you know, the most powerful country in the world, he's also a media figure, you know, in many ways, and he dominates the media almost anywhere in the world on one level. Certainly not in the way that he dominates in the United States, but he still has a presence across the world. And they were interested in his governing style. They were interested in terms of how effective he is as a president. And part of my talk was assessing Donald Trump as president of the United States, and then looking forward to what would happen speculating on 2018, and then of course speculating to 2020. But yes, exceedingly well informed, I would say, about Donald Trump as a figure. But part of what I needed to explain also is the basic structure of how American government and American politics is set up, because people don't realize how confusing of a political system that we have. You know, we got a national government, we got state governments, we got local governments, we got this bizarre thing called the Electoral College, and a lot of my talks sometimes are just trying to make sense out of this very, very strange system.
Well, the Electoral College is something that I think many people, even here in this country, have difficulty understanding. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, President Trump did, in fact, get, what, more than 2 million votes less than Hillary Clinton.
Correct.
But still won.
Right, right. And I think we've talked about this before, that when I actually teach in my Intro American Politics class here, I usually need two full 50-minute lectures to really lay out in detail the Electoral College in terms of why it was created, how it operates, and so forth. So it's a very, very complex subject to sort of explain. I think the other thing that they were also interested in terms of sort of maybe a third broad topic, which is the recent efforts by the Trump administration to impose tariffs, you know, on China and other countries, and again, they were very concerned from sort of a global economy perspective in terms of what this means.
Well, and that's, you know, we do have to take a break. Maybe we can talk about that when we get back, because I actually did go down to Easton, Minnesota, which is in Faribault County, almost on the Iowa border. Did talk to a hog farmer on Monday, and then this was even before. So that was the day that China, I think, fired back, talking about tariffs on any imported pork. Then came China's threat on soybeans,
right?
And this is China seems to be aiming at, you know, for tariffs on products in terms of retaliation to the very states that helped deliver a victory in the Electoral College for President Trump. So let's take a quick break and let's talk about that, because I do think that that's something important. And it does affect people here in Minnesota.
Yes.
And it affects the very people, those rural states or those rural counties, the farmers, all those people who voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump and really did give him a victory. So let's take a break. More with David Schultz after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. It's 8:21 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz, who just came back from a trip teaching in Eastern Europe, want to ask you about these this apparent trade war with China. I think it's fair to call it that at this point.
I was gonna say,
don't you?
We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. That's a trade war.
All right. But I think what's interesting is that the Chinese are firing back. And do you think it's a coincidence that they're firing back with tariffs that are going to hit the very people that really delivered this election for Donald Trump?
I think it's from their perspective, I think it's a very smart move. And I think it is probably very strategic, because you're right, is the targeting of soybeans, the targeting of several other products are and part of it's obviously a consequence of what we're sending to China. But there's no question that when I start to look at the package of things here, it is areas that seem to be coming from, you know, jurisdictions or areas that did vote for Donald Trump. And I think that's smart on their part, because I think they're hoping that whether it's in the short term or the longer term, that'll then squeeze, you know, squeeze representatives in those areas to then put pressure on Donald Trump. And what also becomes interesting now is to the sense that how these tariffs that he's imposing and their response clearly is all about what now it's going to have a major impact on the 2000 or potentially a major impact on the 2018 elections.
Right, the midterm elections, and you know certainly in some cases, and actually Representative Congressman Jason Lewis from Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District is going to be on our WCCO TV Sunday 10:30 a.m. show tomorrow. He's also going to do an extended Facebook Live at 11 a.m. But I do plan to ask him about that, because he certainly represents many, many farm families mm-hmm. in that kind of sprawling 2nd District.
Yep.
And this could potentially affect them. And these are people who voted for Donald Trump. And when I went down to this farm in eastern Minnesota, the farmer there, she told me, we did vote for Trump. And you know, we think he's done a lot of good things. The tax bill really helped us. We do think, that the rural areas were being overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Minnesota almost did go for Donald Trump, but she did express concern. And this was really, this is just when the pork tariff was being talked about by China. Then comes the soybean. Minnesota is one of the top soybean producing states in the entire country.
Yes.
So I think that this is something that is going to continue to play out. It's also taken, it's been a hit in the stock market as well.
Right.
And I think a lot of people are expressing concern there. But I do think China's targeting is to say the least, interesting. And it sounds like you don't think it's coincidental.
I don't think it's coincidental. I think a couple other things to think about in terms of the tariffs and that is that, what should also be recognized here is that some of the tariffs that Trump is going to impose also infecting some consumer goods, which are going to have an impact, of course, across the U.S. economy. But people forget about the fact that a lot of our clothing, our electronic items come from China, which means it'll have an impact across the board for all consumers and make products more expensive. But again, that's going to also have an impact, in many of those, Trump rural areas. And then one other thing to think about, as you started to point out here, is that a lot of what he's doing is starting to really rattle Wall Street. And if in 2017, Trump could sort of, crow about saying that the stock market was up, Dow Jones was up a couple thousand points, he tied his presidency, to the stock market, and now that it's taking these significant hits, he also has to accept that blame in terms of what's happening. And
well, I'm sure he probably won't, but I think critics can certainly point to that.
He has to accept it. No president wants to, of course,
right?
But he's now effectively has married his presidency to the Wall Street, performance on Wall Street, which means that if we go into October, November, and Wall Street is still, taking a pretty big hit. I mean, the gains that occurred in 2017 haven't been eradicated yet, but they're being wiped away. They're gradually being wiped away at this point. And that's been one of the things that he could most point to. And again, what we don't know at this point also is how these trade wars will eventually start to affect what? The U.S. economy in terms of the employment rates and a variety of different things, because I think the other thing he's benefited from is what, about a 4.4%, a 4.1% unemployment rate, you know, pretty good in terms of where it is.
Very good.
All of this is potentially threatened by these trade wars.
Right. And then the tax cut, I mean, obviously many people, many corporations are celebrating that. It's still not clear, you know, in terms of the impact on the deficit down the road.
Right.
I mean, a lot of questions there remain. A lot of people obviously who did benefit, and there are a lot of people who benefited, and certainly corporations benefited, are celebrating that. But there's still questions here.
Many people still haven't gotten really haven't seen much in terms of their paychecks yet. The other thing that was supposed to happen is that with these tax cuts, we were supposed to see several trillion dollars of money being repatriated back into the United States that would be invested in the economy. There's no indications that that's happening, and instead those tax cuts are being translated into dividends and profits for companies. And again, part of the justification for these cuts, you know, was that it was going to lead to the significant investment in the economy. Again,
although it's early.
It's very, very early. You're absolutely correct on all this stuff. But again, these are all the question marks that are out there. And again, the thing that I think that Trump most had going for him going into the 2018 elections along with the Republicans was the fact the economy was doing so well. And the trade wars start to throw that into potential questions here. And again, we don't know what's going to happen in 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. I mean, the real issue is if in October the economy is starting to tank or there's problems in terms of what's happening. That's what the Republicans and Trump have to worry about.
All right. Listen, we have to take a break because we want to give you some weather. I don't know if it was snowing over there in Eastern Europe when you were there.
It was actually – I make people jealous. When I left Minsk on Friday, the day before, 62 degrees.
Okay, I am jealous. Anyway,
yeah.
We do have to give you the forecast because there's more snow on that. But when we come back, I want to talk about some of the big events that happened. Or probably the biggest is Governor Tim Pawlenty announcing that he is going to run for his own. It's 8:33 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, along with Professor David Schultz. One of the things that happened this past week, perhaps obviously the biggest news story politically of this past week here in Minnesota, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty getting into the governor's race. Your thoughts?
Well, first, I think we were all expecting him to do this about a month ago because the
right.
rumor started quite a while ago. But yeah, he finally did, and it was and. I think it's kind of interesting because I watched his video, and when I watched his video, you know, he's trying to run on the one hand, I think, as somebody who's going to defend, you know, sort of, you know, give, as he said, you know, help the working class, and trying to maybe appeal to sort of those Trump voters. But I think he's going to have a hard time doing so for a couple of reasons. First is that he was sharply critical of Trump, even though in his video, after his video, he said that he voted for Trump, you know, and supports some of the stuff. But he sharply criticized Trump before. And I think, too, a second problem for Pawlenty, you know, while at one time he ran as sort of the, you know, the white working class person, you know, from, you know, who became governor, you know, he's now a millionaire. I think he's going to have a hard time appealing. So he's got that. He's got the fact that he's been out of the limelight for a long time. But I think the single biggest problem he really faces when I watch the video is sort of twofold. He needs a narrative, an explanation as to why he wants to be governor. I don't think he has one. And then two, he's already very well defined by lots of people in terms of who he is. And I think he's going to have a hard time shedding that.
Right. Oh, and, you know, I don't think, I think you've got some very interesting points and important points. I don't think people really would quibble so much if he had made millions
right.
doing perhaps in entrepreneurial endeavors or something
right.
like that. But I do think it's going to be tough to sell, you know, that he empathizes with the working class when he was a lobbyist for big banks. I mean, I think that's harder. I don't think Americans certainly, and you can look at President Trump's election, I don't think Americans fault people for making money.
No, they don't.
They really don't. I think people look at it and say, well, good for him. And I think there probably will be people who say that, you know, in support of Governor Tim Pawlenty. But I do remember he did, you know, in his successful runs for governor, he did talk about, you know, growing up, and which he did. That hasn't changed. You know, he grew up in very modest circumstances.
That's right.
And so I think he's going to try and do that again. But I will people hold the lobbying thing against him. Certainly his opponents are. And certainly I think Jeff Johnson, the Hennepin County Commissioner, who is the leading Republican candidate at this point, will also trying to navigate the Trump issue. And I think this is really an issue that just has made a couple of Minnesota politicians and certainly other politicians around the country just squirm trying to twist themselves into pretzel knots.
Right.
One of them is Eric Paulson saying, you know, I don't support him, but, you know, then I voted for him or I didn't vote for him. So what Governor Pawlenty said is after the Access Hollywood tape came out, which was about 10 days or so right before the 2016 election, obviously very awkward, very embarrassing. A lot of people came out and denounced Trump. One of them was Governor Pawlenty, who said that he was unfit and unhinged and unfit to be president. And then now he says he did vote for him. And so that was new. But I think that's going to be difficult. I mean, that being said, this is the last man who won a statewide office as a Republican.
Right.
And it's hard to believe that was 12 years ago now. So, you know, and I think what's possibly being set up here is that, you know, the nominating convention is the 1st through the 2nd in June, which is actually, that's pretty darn soon. It's less than 2 months.
It is.
And you know, if he doesn't get the nomination, you're setting them, they're basically, it's being set up for a grueling, ugly primary fight all summer between him and most likely Jeff Johnson.
Right. And I think this is not what the Republicans want to see because they're basically going to beat each other up. There's no question about it. In fact, I think Jeff Johnson is going to be pretty deadly in terms of the attacks that he's going to raise against Pawlenty. And the Democrats are obviously doing the same thing at this point, too. You know, but you already see Jeff Johnson coming out and talking about saying that, well, when Pawlenty left office, he left the state $6 billion in the hole, talked about the crumbling infrastructure, talked about the bridge that fell. Now, whether some of these things you can blame on Pawlenty or not, matter of debate. But you've got a similar set of critiques coming from Jeff Johnson from the Republican side, and I'm assuming it's going to be from Downey and perhaps others. At the same time, you're getting those coming from the Democrats who have already been going after him pretty hard. But what this is going to mean is that if Pawlenty were to get the nomination, and I am not convinced he gets the nomination necessarily, or even wins if he's not going to go to the convention, I don't think, and I'm not sure he actually gets the primary endorsement either. But if he does, he will go into the general election with a lot of wounds and probably after a very, very divisive battle this summer.
Right. So that remains to be seen. It's possible you could have something like that on the Democratic side for governor, with Tim Walz saying, you know, that he may not abide by the endorsement. And their nominating convention is that same weekend in June, that first and second. I think June 1st is a Friday.
Right.
It's the 1st and 2nd. So that's going to be really interesting to see what happens with that one as well.
Yeah, because I can very well see at this point that there is no endorsement in the convention also, and this also takes us to an August primary. Right now, I think the most likely would be Rebecca Otto and Tim Walz. I know Erin Murphy's still in the race, but she's a distant third. And again, that's the same thing in terms of a potentially ugly primary battle. And as we know, when we look at primaries, you know, in our August primaries, we're looking at a turnout of somewhere between about 4 and 9% normally. I mean, it's not very good, which means it's a logic of small numbers. And when you get to that low of number of people showing up, almost anything can happen. It's about what? Moving core base supporters. As we know, first week of August, almost nobody is thinking about elections. You know, we're thinking about our cabins, we're thinking about a whole bunch of other stuff. Upshot being is that I think it's wide open at that point. I think if it goes to a primary on both sides, it's wide open.
Right, and it's I believe the primary is August 14th, and it's just not a great time of year. Minnesota people are thinking about everything else except for going to the polls, or else they're not here.
That's right.
You know, they're at their cabins, or they're on vacation, or. Doing what you do in August in Minnesota, having fun.
And if summer ever comes, we might actually be thinking about summer.
Right. If summer ever comes, that is true. Another thing that happened while you were away is Vice President Mike Pence came to town to talk about the benefits of the tax cuts to Minnesota. And he also gave a strong, show of support, shout out to Minnesota's three Republican incumbent members of Congress. They, of course, are Tom Emmer, Eric Paulson, and Jason Lewis, saying how important it was for them to be reelected. And he especially stressed, he obviously was talking about Congressman Emmer and Lewis, but he really did, emphasize Congressman Paulson, who he had served with in Congress.
Right.
Obviously, probably more of a personal connection there. Is Mike Pence, is he going to be the person who does the heavy lifting for the Trump administration on trying to make sure that, from the Republican standpoint, that they achieve their goal of holding on to the House and Senate?
Well, I think clearly yes. And I think you may see Pence going into the districts like Paulson's where Trump is not popular. And look at a district like his, and I also believe Jason Lewis's, I believe Hillary Clinton won in both of those congressional districts. And sending Trump in those to campaign is probably not a good idea, whereas Pence, I think, becomes less threatening to some of the Clinton supporters or to some of those swing voters in those districts. And so, yes, I'm expecting to see him more likely there. I wouldn't even be surprised if he heads down to the first district now that that's being abandoned by Tim Walz to run for governor. But I think Pence is going to become very important because there are going to be areas of the country where Trump is not going to be an effective campaigner because he's just not popular by comparison.
Right. And I'm going to look up who won the congressional district in terms of the presidential race. I do know, and there's an interesting dynamic in the second district, and it has to do with Jason Lewis was outspent 4-1 practically by Angie Craig, a business woman who put $1 million of her own money in. Completely outspent, and he won. The interesting thing is that there was a third-party candidate in that race who got, I think, 28,000 votes.
She got about 7% of the vote,
which is a lot, and because it was
about 1.5% margin of victory, if I remember correctly.
Right. I mean, it was narrow, and now that candidate, Paul Overby, is going to be running. I think she's trying to get the Green Party endorsement to run in the Senate race. Where Amy Klobuchar is running for election. So one could presume that Paula Overy took more from Angie Craig than she did from Jason Lewis. I think that's a fair assumption.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in that race, I remember when that happened back in 2016, I mean, I made the argument with a couple of my friends, who I think follow politics pretty closely. I said that as a third-party candidate, if she's up to about 5% of the vote, it doesn't come out of anybody's hides because of the fact these will be people who support her independently. But I argued that for every vote over 5%, given the position she was running on, she would probably hurt Angie Craig. And that's exactly what happened. Now, the other thing which will be interesting to look at here, in that race in the second district, Angie Craig won all the counties with the exception, I believe, of, was it Scott County or Carver County? I can't remember which one it was now. So if she's smart going into this election, what she wants to figure out is how to win that county because she lost, I think it was Scott County, lost it pretty significantly, and that was really the margin of error or margin of difference that elected Jason Lewis in that race.
Right, and we don't, it used to be when Governor Tim Pawlenty was governor, and he was running, that you would see these strong showings by independent party candidates, and you really don't see that as much anymore.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the polarization we see nationwide, we know, has also affected Minnesota, and that polarization also means that we're seeing people less willing to vote for third-party candidates. I mean, the race that I really saw everything change was 2002. You know, it's the polarization really kicked in when Paul Wellstone's plane crashed and then the memorial service. And I always remind people and say that when Paul Wellstone's plane crashed, the day before it crashed, in the governor's race, you know, we had, at that point, we had Tim Penny running, we had Tim Pawlenty running, and we had Roger Moe, and Tim Penny was actually in the lead. And when that plane crashed, within about like 72 hours, Tim Penny dropped by about 10 points. Roger Moe dropped, picked up a little bit, but Tim Penny was the big beneficiary on that one. And something about that plane crash, the memorial service, not just statewide, but part of a nationwide movement that maybe hyper-polarized politics. And really, Minnesota's been changed since then, because since that election, third-party candidates have not done well at all.
All right. Chatting with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. We're going to take a quick break. Some closing thoughts with him after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. It's 8:52 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy back with Professor David Schultz. Actually, I did find something here on who won that second congressional district in 2016. Donald Trump actually won the second congressional district.
Oh, he did win it.
He did win it, not by a lot, 46 to about 45. So I think it's 1.5 percentage points. But it's interesting because surveys showed that Clinton was expected to win.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in fact, Angie Craig, a month out, had a 5-point lead in that district. And Jason Lewis benefited from that surge of Trump support.
Yep. Yeah.
So it's interesting, though, that you look at those surveys that are a month out. And I think it's a reminder that 2016 election is a reminder for all of us as we sit here and look and try and figure out what's going to happen, that the electorate can be very unpredictable, and it's really not clear the degree to which people will turn out, the degree to which people are energized. It appears people are energized on both sides,
right?
But you can't always predict things, and it did look like Angie Craig was going to win that race.
It did look like that one. I mean, a couple things to keep in mind here also is that we had probably about 10% undecided in that race, you know, in the presidential race, you know, because we shouldn't forget the fact that both Clinton and Trump had disapprovals of about 60%. I mean, they were two of the least popular candidates, you know, since surveys had been done. And I mention that because there were people who were going back and forth with the classic, you know, voting for the lesser of two evils in their mind. And what generally happens also is that when you get the undecided voters obviously make up their mind at the last minute, and when they do so, more often than not, they break against the incumbent. And Clinton was essentially running as the incumbent, you know, the third term for Obama administration. So it's not a surprise that in some sense that a race, I suspect down there in October, you probably had 10 or 15% undecided, that they break at the last minute and they break for Donald Trump, because we saw that nationwide.
Right. And so it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. And, you know, it really, when you look at it, the president's support, you know, people, you know, say he's taking a hit or whatever. I mean, in a lot of these polls, especially the ones that turned out to be right in 2016, I think Rasmussen was the only one, he's really sort of been at the same level.
Right.
Which I don't know if that's good or bad, or, you know, he's always sort of been at that lower level. I don't think he hasn't gone up, but, he, you know, if you look at the overall, I don't think that he's gone down that much, at least.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to fluctuate a little bit down, But if you're saying he's in the upper 30s, 40% approval, you know, he's pretty much holding there. And so you're absolutely right. The question becomes now, how does, you know, that distribution of 40%, how it plays out across the country in terms of, is it evenly distributed? No. It's concentrated in certain districts? Yes. How does it play out in terms of those 20 or 25 swing congressional districts across the country that are going to really determine the balance of power? I mean, that's what we need to know more, is how geographically or spatially distributed his support is. Because, and again, I can speak confidently and say that Eric Paulson's district was one that went pretty strongly for Clinton, and that's
almost 10 points.
Right. And that's something that Eric Paulson has to worry about.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, Professor David Shultz, so great to have you back in the U.S. of A.
Yes.
Welcome back, and thank you so much for coming back on so quickly after your return.
No problem. Thank you very much, and thanks, everybody, and have a good evening.
Absolutely. Take care, and also be sure to check in to David Shultz's blog, Shultz's Take. Always a pleasure, and always a pleasure to have him on, especially after a long trip back from Eastern Europe. Please tune in to WCCO-TV Sunday morning, 6 a.m., 10:30 a.m. Mike Augustinak and I will be there with the snow. Thanks to David Josephson, the producer of this show, Shaletta Brundage, and also Jonathan Lowe, studio coordinators and producers, too.